You're listening to OWW Radio,
the official radio show of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com.
All right, so here we are, living it day by day. You are a superstar, and that's what she used to always say.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to OWW Radio. I am your host, Alex Goff, and this week I am pleasure to be joined by Chris Harrington. He's a contributor at a few different websites, VoicesOfWrestling.com and What Culture, and also he has a blog at IndeedWrestling.com. Chris, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing wonderful. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you for joining us. And then, so clear this up for me. Back in 2007, when I first started listening to wrestling podcasts, from what I understand, you may have been the first wrestling podcast I ever listened to.
That would be incredible if that's true. I did host a podcast for a couple of years called Indeed Wrestling Weekly, which was hardly weekly. But so if that's the podcast you're thinking of, possibly.
Yes, that was back then. It was an interesting time in my life. I had just become somewhat independent after joining the military. And then on iTunes, I figured out you could listen to specific radio shows tailored to your interest, known as podcasts. I don't know if I knew the term for them yet. And I think I just put in wrestling, and or maybe Dave Meltzer. And then I believe your show was one of the ones that popped up. Now, from what I understand, your co-host is now somewhat successful, I guess, in the forum of pro wrestling?
Yeah, one of my co-hosts. So at the time, I hosted under the nom de plume of Vic Whittle, and one of my regular co-hosts, T.T. Watts, is now someone you can see regularly on Monday Night Raw and SmackDown. So he definitely moved past the realm of podcasting and found another way to make a buck in wrestling. But he remembers his day fondly, for sure.
Well, there you go. And that's very, very interesting. And nowadays, I don't remember at the time, maybe you covered it then as well, but now I think a lot of people in the communities that I follow, they know you for your analytics, right? You're very big in the numbers, very big in the developing models to substantiate claims. Can you kind of explain, as I assume the numbers... I assume numbers weren't born out of professional wrestling, right? Like, you didn't one day watch IRS and think, like, man, like, I want to get into numbers. So kind of explain how, I guess, your love of numbers developed and then how you decided to apply it to pro wrestling.
Okay. I've for a long time here just been the sort of person that if someone makes a claim and it feels like it can be substantiated using numbers on the Internet, that's always been interesting to me. So I was someone who grew up with a computer in the household. I had my Apple IIe, and I programmed on that when I was a kid. And when I got a little bit older, I used to call BBSs and do a lot of things on that. And so I was always interested in computers and things like that. And when I got into college and started doing what they call econometrics, which is kind of, you know, the combination of statistics and economics, I got really excited at, you know, the ability to use statistical models to try to maybe understand bigger things. And I had always been interested in wrestling, especially in high school. And some of my buddies, including my co-host there, were, you know, guys that we would wrestle in the local federations and before that in the backyard federations, of course. So I loved wrestling and that sort of thing. And it was always something that I noticed that keeping in wrestling was pretty poor and spotty at best because, of course, being a work sport, there wasn't nearly as much emphasis on it. So different times I would find ways I could mine the data and try to pull out information. I remember one of my econometrics papers in college that I wrote was actually about the PWI rankings and trying to figure out, was there any rhyme or reason to why people get their PWI rankings? Can you correlate it to big title wins or how they ranked in years past or things like that? And so, you know, I think there's just a subculture of people that enjoy lists. And, of course, during the Attitude Era, there's all those great almanacs that were getting printed off in magazines. Oftentimes we're covering a lot of different federations, and there's so many boomers. And so almost as a way to contribute to the kind of growing conscientiousness about wrestling at the time, numbers happened to be one of the things that I really got excited about. And I remember one of the first times I started to kind of do a project just for myself was like trying to keep win-loss records for Jack, for who was going to be the king of the jobbers. You know, would it be Midian or Crash Holly, or who was the greatest of the lowest ranking wrestlers at the time? And that was just a lot of fun. And so from that, I just continued to post numbers, and I think my big break really came 2006, 2007, when over at the Death Valley Driver Board, they started their Best of the 1980s compilation disc. And they were, at the time, they were kind of doing a beta run with WWF. And I offered, hey, I'd be happy to tally the ballots and run some statistics on it. And, you know, that's kind of one of those jobs that is fun to some people and just the absolute bane of their existence to others. So the guys running the project were happy to kind of toss it over to me. And I did an okay job with it, so they kept leaving me on for the project. And so now we're on project number 8 or 9 at the Lucha set here, and covering Memphis and all Japan, New Japan, other Japan, all these other sets we've done in the past. And that was really kind of the way I started to break through, was the stat geek king of wrestling. And then a few years ago, I started my own Kickstarter and did a kind of a pitch for a wrestling book about statistics, very unclear what I was going to do with it. And a whole bunch of people were very generous and gave in to the project. And so 2 years later, I'm still working on it. And kind of as I've been publishing little bits and pieces of what would go in the book and also things that I worked on but cannot fit in the book, my reputation has maybe blossomed. And so it's been fun sharing a lot of things with Dave Meltzer, and occasionally he reprints them in the newsletter. And then occasionally those will take a life of their own because, like last week, Chris Jericho called me out on his podcast because he was reading the Wrestling Observer list that Dave had printed of win-loss records. You know, not a very complex analysis by any means, but this, you know, fascinated this wrestler that someone had pulled up these numbers, which is funny because it's really compared to the work that a lot of other really good wrestling websites and databases are doing. What I'm doing is very, very tiny in that larger realm of kind of data collection. But it you know, it helps answer people's questions and it gets them excited. And, you know, every time you print a win-loss record, that's something that people can really get their teeth around because it's a lot like other sports and they get that idea. And so it's fun for them. And then that can be a gateway to kind of go on to other things. And I think I'm like anybody else in that sense.
You know, what's interesting is that when I first started following professional wrestling, right, I didn't keep detailed statistics anywhere, so I was very relied upon Dave Meltzer to make an off comment. Like, for example, the buy rate for this pay-per-view was this, I noticed this trend, whatever. But now, because your articles and your pieces are kind of geared toward where you make the claim and then you substantiate it by showing how you've gotten to this number, no longer does, I guess, the journalist of that elk kind of have a monopoly on seeing the numbers, right? Because you actually display your work, and therefore people who do podcasts like this one were able to substantiate our claims a lot better. Now, I think, and I wonder if you've encountered this at all, the frustrated wrestling fans, because wrestling's a very emotional sport. And so when you attempt to substantiate claims, like, for example, this guy didn't work, or maybe this angle didn't work, which I haven't seen a specific piece where you discuss that, but the emotional wrestling fans who, you know, well, I enjoyed this or whatever, have you ever encountered that in any of your numbers discussions?
Absolutely. So recently I did a piece about Raw ratings movers, and I looked at 2011 through 2013, and basically, what was the viewership change during Raw while people were on screen? So when Brock Lesnar came on and a million more people watched, that Brock Lesnar would get credit for a million people. And then if JTG was wrestling 3MB and they lost 500,000 people, they would all get negative 500. And then I did this over a very large time period to try to take out some of those peaks and valleys that you're going to get, those one-week Batista get 6 million viewer type strangeness, and published it and just said, hey, here's what I found. You know, here's my data set. Here's what I found. It's not perfect. It's, you know, there's different competition every night of the year. There's different reasons that people are programmed where they are. If you're in the overrun segment, you're going to get a lot more eyeballs than if you're at the death spot at 10:15 or whatever. So this is not by any means of pure science, but it's interesting. And a lot of people looked at it and said, well, this is bunk because Daniel Bryan isn't showing as the number one ratings draw for 2013, and Jim Ross was a huge ratings draw in 2011. I don't understand that, so it can't be true. And as opposed to, you know, coming at it and saying, well, let's look at what was really going on during these time periods and where these people were programmed and when they're injured and what programs they're in to understand a little bit more to it. And it was funny because when I wrote it up, I knew it would be not exactly controversial, but I knew it would be popular because just putting a Twitter post out of it had exploded and people started retweeting it all night. And so I realized that, and so I just put a sentence in there and I said, twist this to justify whatever your theory is, because I know no matter how strongly I word it as this is what the numbers mean, especially when I try to word and say, I don't know what these numbers mean exactly, because you can make a lot of inferences from it. People just use it to justify whatever they think their base scenario is. And that's one thing you always have to kind of split yourself from is, as a fan, this is what I like. As a analyst, this is what I think. So I might say, as a fan, I love the WWE Network. As an analyst, I think it should cost more. And, you know, that's not always what fans want to hear. And so sometimes you do get that kind of feedback of either you're ignorant, you're wrong, you messed up. And, of course, the worst thing is when you do a study and you make a conclusion and then later you realize you had a flaw in your study. And you feel really bad about that. But it's funny because all the times I've written retractions or tried to fix my work, no one ever cares. It's like, it's almost like they read it for what they wanted to get out of it in the first place a lot of the time. And I think there might be, of course, a silent majority that are reading it and comprehending it and trying to come up with their own conclusions and their own ideas. But oftentimes, wrestling is such a subjective thing. Is that a good match? Is that not a good match? That it's really hard to boil those down into numbers that then I can compare and say, you take my methodology, you do it yourself, and come up with the same results. So, there's so many pieces to that. But I definitely have encountered those things where someone says, well, I love Naked Midian. Well, how dare you say that he wasn't worth anything to the company at the time?
I think that's a very, very good example because, throughout my years of being a fan of professional wrestling, there's not a monopoly on, like, what it was and what instance got people into professional wrestling. And there may very well be fans out there that, for example, saw Naked Midian, for example, thought that was hilarious. And people's expectations of professional wrestling aren't uniform as well. Like, what I expect and enjoy from my professional wrestling isn't always the same as potentially you or other people that you'll discuss it with. But I have to say, one piece recently that you did that I did kind of shake my head at was the inference that I can use statistical numbers to decide what you may like on the WWE Network. You used 4- and 5-star matches rated by Dave Meltzer and said that, this may be something that new fans may be interested in the network, and I've used Dave Meltzer's star ratings before, for example, to get into Japanese professional wrestling, but it was kind of, because I guess pro wrestling is such a personal, emotional thing from time to time, I can't believe he used star ratings to say, check this out on the network, but then once I stepped back and thought about it, I guess that would be a good way for someone to check out the network for the first time.
You know, a lot of people, that star ratings is a great example of where the characteristics of was it good or bad mesh up with the business numbers of, well, how did it actually do? Did we make money? Did we lose money? What can we tell from the final report? And so one of the reasons I like a star rating is because it's the best, worst resource we have. It's not by any means infallible, and it's not by any means a source of truth that is the only truth. But what I love is that it covers 30 years, and it covers them with the same person applying their values about being interested in the product at the time and giving out what he thought it was worth. Now, sometimes I'll weigh it against things like the Observer polls, which have, 100, 200, maybe 500 people responding to say, these are the matches we really liked this year, and things like that. And that can be a nice counterbalance to it all. I definitely think Dave, like any other analyst, like a Roger Ebert, almost of his genre, is going to carry a lot of weight in terms of does he like it, does he not like it, and he's going to direct people sometimes to influence their thinking on that. But by no means do I think that he's infallible. I just think I like it because it's a steady resource that is always the same person responding and giving his view and doing it at the time that the match was happening, not 10 years later, not 20 years later. And if I find other resources where someone else has gone through and rated this many matches over this much time, I would love to use those too if I think that there's, any criteria he's applying against it that makes sense, or she, for that matter.
What's interesting is that, since I've started subscribing to the network since the launch, What I find entertaining is not necessarily going back and watching the old matches, but going and watching the builds, which is why I think this day is a lot more valuable than the UFC network long term, because the builds in mixed martial arts, for example, are pretty much they're not always there. But in WWE, all the good big matches have these great builds, and you can go back and watch them. Now, when people start subscribing to the network, you notice something about the numbers they were given, and you found a way to be able to maybe track how many people were signing up for the network. Can you explain that and what you found from those numbers?
Sure. So credit here really goes to David Bixenspan, who was one of the people who first really called out this phenomenon, which was that numbers, when you ordered the WWE Network in the early morning of the 24th, you would get a receipt, and it would say order number XXXXX, and it was this enormously large number that started with 1-6. And what Dave noticed was it appeared these numbers were sequential. People started to report them to him. And then Ian Hamilton, who's another wrestling researcher and writer, suggested, well, what if we think X number is the first number and everything is kind of going incrementally off that? And so the two of them kind of started this whole discussion. I came in very late in the conversation. I just kind of noticed it, what they were talking about, and said, oh, that'd be really neat. And so Dave went ahead, set up a way to start collecting these numbers, and then was gracious enough to turn the data set over to me. And so what I started to do was take all the numbers, and it had basically said, what was your order number? What time did you actually receive the email from WWE? And we learned, what time zone people were reporting in. And when you normalized it all to, say, Eastern time zone, it actually formed a really linear graph where from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m., a certain number of people signed up. Then from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., nobody signed up as the servers crashed. From 1 p.m. to 2 p.m., all those people that had signed up during those kind of other hours kind of all came through as one big batch, especially in the first 30 minutes. And then from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock, we settled into what I would call almost a steady state of about 25,000 people an hour. So in total, I think we ended up finding maybe 140,000 people between the hours of 9 a.m. and 4 p.m. Around 4:15 p.m., WWE turned off giving these numbers out. Now, was that because we were tracking them? Was it because they were caught up? I have no idea. But for whatever reason, WWE stopped reporting these numbers around 4:15 p.m. So we only had that four-hour period of time of real data from 8 to 9 and 1 to 4. But from that, it gave us some interesting numbers. 140,000 people signing up in the first, essentially, 4 or 5 hours of the service. Well, those are the hardcore fans. We also discovered a huge percentage of those people that were reporting into our report were from Europe, getting us in the GMT time zone. And it was almost 17% of our sample set. And what was interesting with that is Dave Meltzer on the Wrestling Observer Board did a poll of his data of the people subscribing, and they, at about a similar percentage of 17% of Europeans, said they were using ways to basically tunnel into the WWE network. Now, I don't think the final WWE numbers are going to be close to 17%. I think that's really more of an indication of the people that tend up very early on in the day. But I thought it was really interesting that a much larger piece of the pie than I think anybody had suspected was going to be non-United States people signing up for the WWE Network, which will possibly impact the international launch going on. Now, unfortunately, when you only have data set from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., what we're missing is that huge get home from work, get home from school, watch Monday Night Raw, remember that the network is launching, sign up, period. And so you can come up with any time of sky numbers you want to try to guess how many more people signed up. I think I put my estimate somewhere north of 300,000. Obviously, I don't know. So by no means is that verbatim truth, but 300,000 would definitely be in the low range of what would be feasible for day one. Day one through seven, we don't really know again, but we can run some other numbers looking at different indications people gave, and we get kind of a clue of we probably are north of 500,000 subscribers at least for the network. Some people are going to say 1 million. Some people are going to say 2 million. I personally don't think we're near 1 million yet because, A, WWE hasn't sent out a giant press release, which I kind of feel like they would just to tout it, and, B, there's only 4.5 million people watching Monday Night Raw on any given night in the United States for households. So the idea that somehow 25% of the viewing population is already on the network seems really high to me. So especially for something that is a streaming network, it's not available on your television. You have to go through some other means, be it a Roku or a Chromecast or an Apple TV or a gaming console to get it. So there's a lot of numbers I threw out there, but the basic fact is we know that at least 150,000 people signed up really quickly. And from that, I'm guessing somewhere between 300,000 signed up on the first day, and we're maybe up to 500,000 or more after about a week and a half into this process. So a decent launch, but always keep in mind they need 1 million to break even on this on a profit-wise basis. So 500,000 sounds like a lot of people, but you got to remember there's a lot of revenue that they're hurting on themselves by launching this thing.
You know, what's interesting is that you're not the only one that's made the argument that the thing is too cheap. Bill Simmons wrote a column for Grantland.com where him and his writer, David Shoemaker, did a big piece on the network. And that was one of the things he said as well, is that when you calculate someone who paid for all the pay-per-views annually, and then if you had the network at $20 a month, they would still be paying, I forgot what the exact number is, but not even 100% of what someone would be paying if you bought all the pay-per-views a month. Therefore, you'd still be getting a great discount considering the fact you're getting all the old catalog and all the pay-per-views every month. And something else I found interesting and something I've been talking about for a few weeks on this podcast is that when the WWE Network was just a talking point, right, something that they would discuss at the investors' meetings, it seemed like a big fantasy, like no way WWE is going to be able to launch something this big, right? And then when it launched, and then when I was able to get my hands on it, I'm in the camp of people that are convinced that this has just changed content delivery for brands till the end of time. And Bill Simmons had some very interesting ways that Major League Baseball and the NBA can capitalize on the same concept of presenting old material and new material and even hybrids of still maintaining television contracts. From, I guess, an emotional or even from an analytic standpoint, how do you think this changed the way that content will be delivered in the future?
Well, you make a good point there, which was if you go back and you read all the WWE Network coverage, I did this back in November when I was trying to basically put a small piece together about what is the WWE Network going to look like. And the thing that comes over again and again and again is that it was envisioned much more as a premium channel, much like an HBO or Classics on Demand would be on your television, that they would go for a television operator. And it really wasn't until late November, early December that the rumors came out about them instead going in a much more digital, over-the-top, as they say, a manner akin to a Netflix or a Hulu or Major League Baseball, the MLB app. So that was really interesting. And what's intriguing about it is it's probably the right decision for a 10-year-out plan. You know, looking forward in the future, it makes a ton of sense to do it this way. For the here and now, it's a really risky proposition. And when George Barros, the CFO for WWE, was asked about it, he basically said, we investigated this. We didn't think it was feasible until just now. Today is the day we think. Now, of course, they're going to say right before they launch it, now is the only time it can work. But for them, they looked at the growth of Netflix, and they looked at the growth of Hulu, and they looked at the growth of the MLB, the AB app. And from there, it really told them that maybe there's a market that's going to be large enough for a subscription video over the top, and you see Nielsen, and you see Gallup, and you see a lot of the other major poll companies that have historically looked at media markets starting to really report on how many people are watching Netflix and what is the profile of those people. And so I think it's the right move in the sense that it's great for people that have the ability to, you know, have smart TVs, have internet-connected Blu-ray players. My father-in-law and my father both that way were in the last 3 years here. They had both gotten smart devices in their homes that allow them to watch Netflix directly through some thing they bought, be it the television or the Blu-ray player. I think that's huge because it really changes the way that people are interacting with that media, and it changes their attitude towards, am I watching it on my computer screen versus am I watching it on my television? And we have just discovered as older adults, they're very tied to the idea of watching things on television. And so if you can bring that experience to the television, it transforms it for them. Now, for younger people, they're more used to the mobile and the tablet and the computer screen and other ways of interacting with that media. So it feels very natural to them. And that's one of the reasons that I think a lot of people are overestimating the adoption of something like the WWE Network today, is because they see it as just the natural outgrowth of them because they use the Netflix. They already are the type of person that subscribes to maybe the online newsletter. And the idea of digital, you know, a newspaper subscription or a landline, that seems very outdated and old to them. What I always throw back at them is WWE, the average age is over the age of 34. More than half of their population that is watching their program is over the age of 34. And so only thinking of it as a millennial generation is probably the wrong thinking in terms of thinking about how they consume media and deal with it. But there's a huge opportunity in the future here. The problem is making the money work. And right now, it's just not at a point where it's going to generate billions of dollars for WWE especially. They're very lucky that they don't have to pay the content licensing fees that someone like Netflix does that pays billions of dollars on every year in content licensing because WWE owns their library. And that's really the only reason that makes sense for them. And that's also why it would make a lot of sense for other sports franchises that own their library and own the rights to that library. Now, whether or not they will end up in some kind of weird royalty deals, I have no idea how that might impact them. The other thing that I think is a huge risk out there is just patent trolls possibly coming after some of these online video subscription services and saying, you owe us a lot of money because 25 years ago I invented the idea of streaming video over a BBS modem, and coming after them and trying to get a whole lot of money. So I think that might happen in the future here because we've already seen that happening with podcasts going on here. So there's some legal troubles that could lay ahead. And, of course, net neutrality issues about whether or not any of the providers are going to reduce the bandwidth for some of these streaming services to come through the pipe and come into your home. But overall, it is the right move, and it's kind of amazing that WWE, almost through the misfortune of not being able to get along with the MVPD, the multi-channel video programming distributors, the cable companies and satellite companies, that they ended up in this direction, which is probably the best move for the long-term future, but it's definitely going to be a very shaky and very disruptive thing for them today. Just getting back to something you said earlier about the pricing on the network, I completely agree with where people are coming from when they say, if you really rationalize how much people are paying for this thing, it's almost so much for $10, because you had over 100,000 homes every month buying B-level pay-per-views. So they were paying $45 to $55 in a month. So $10 from 45, that's a huge savings to them. You had probably on top of that number, another 200,000 people who were those one-time buyers. They're like me. They buy Royal Rumble, they buy the SummerSlam, they buy WrestleMania. So then maybe they spend three times a year. And you work that out, that's almost $12 a month if you were to annualize kind of what they're spending. And it's only those one-time-a-year buyers, those WrestleMania buyers, and they're right at that edge there where, you know, if you're spending $60 on WrestleMania, well, over 12 months, that's $5. So, yes, you're spending more on wrestling, but you've already shown a perchance and interest in spending money on wrestling. So more than half of their pay-per-view base there was already spending a lot more than $10 a month. And so the idea of then giving them it to it is a huge discount. And that's one of the reasons why I think if the service does not hit the million subscribers by the end of 2014, we will see a 20 to 25% price increase coming in 2015.
The big thing that they discussed, and I want to get your opinion on this before we continue, is how they got to this concept, they say, is because pay-per-view is dead. Now, we've heard that statement a million times, not only from World Wrestling Entertainment, but I believe TNA has publicly made negative connotations about pay-per-view. Have you looked at any numbers surrounding pay-per-view, and what is your thoughts on the health of the pay-per-view business?
Well, it's really funny because when you go back to the early 1990s and you go read journals like Broadcasting and Cable News, what you'll see is that back in the early 90s, after there being this initial kind of ramp up of pay-per-view, things started to slump. And part of that reason it slumped was we did have a little bit of that mini recession going on in the early 90s, and oftentimes, you know, this is the kind of disposable income people chose to pull back on. You had some consolidation going on from the networks. And so, you know, what was maybe a little more of a mom-and-pop type operation is began to kind of regionalize in many cases across different areas of the United States. And you see articles where people are talking about they want to raise pay-per-view prices by $2.50 this is ludicrous. Pay-per-view is a dying business in like 1991, 1992. And so it's so funny when you go ahead 16 plus years and start seeing there still is million by UFC fights going on. You see WrestleManias that are getting 800,000 domestic buys at $60 a pop. And you see that the worldwide market for pay-per-view continues to grow. And so of the, I think it's $82 million in pay-per-view they did last year, something around $67 million of it was domestic. $67 million domestic, I think, is the second largest single revenue stream for WWE if you split up live events into domestic and international live events. And so it by no means is a tiny chunk of the pie. You know, it is a huge piece of what WWE had going on. And so it was by no means dead. In fact, it was probably leveled from about a year ago. It's down a little bit, but in essence, they found where they were going to sit. Now, I think they made a huge mistake when they broke the $40 barrier for WWE back in the 2010 era, because we were really at high unemployment in the United States. And you also saw that they were doing a little bit of trying to just chase UFC because they thought they'd be seen as inferior if their events cost less than UFC's events. So they were almost forced into making this price increase. And while historically those price increases worked for WWE, this one was really a time when I think a lot of people just said, I'd rather pirate this, or I'd rather just not spend the money. Or, you know what, Raw is moving to 3 hours now. I can get enough wrestling in a week. I don't really need to spend the extra money for this pay-per-view event. So in the sense of, if you build it, they will come? No. But if you make something that people want, sure. So we're seeing that with UFC right now, where they are with the events that the people really want to see. If GSP is fighting, people pay their money and they'll go see it. If it's events that are really good athletes that they don't think of as stars, people don't pay the money to go see it. And wrestling's been along that same way. And what wrestling has struggled with is they have realized that you can put The Rock on a B pay-per-view, you can put him on Survivor Series against R-Truth and The Miz, and yes, you will get a bump, but it's probably not a big enough bump. And so people are really getting to the point where they're saying monthly pay-per-view is almost too much consumption for me to really think of it as a big event. And so those big events that I've been trying to think of as big, Royal Rumble, SummerSlam, WrestleMania, those three still matter. Survivor Series stopped mattered a long time ago, and it's just by the legacy of when it came up in the chronology of wrestling that people think of it as a big four pay-per-view, but it really wasn't. So one of my suggestions for WWE is actually get WrestleMania off the network. You can sell the network without WrestleMania. You can sell WrestleMania to a lot of the casual buyers at the full price, and you'll still make a lot of money. And the reality is a lot of people would still buy it on full-price pay-per-view, and WWE is getting $30 a buy rather than WWE getting less than $10 a buy for something that's commoditized, which is some, or another reason Dana White was dismissive of the WWE network was not only because it you know, interferes and makes his fight pass possibly look weaker, but also because they put their big events on there, and he did not understand why you take a juggernaut like WrestleMania and then essentially say it's only worth $10. Because as soon as you've done that, you basically killed the value of that brand. And so that's something we've seen over and over again, is that when WWE treats their stuff like it's not worth it, people think of it that way. And so they run a huge risk right now. I think it was great for getting people enticed to buy the WWE network. I think it's the right time for interest. But in 2015 or 2016, as an analyst, I would bite my lip at them keeping the WrestleMania on the network. What do you think?
I agree with a lot of what you said. The thing about professional wrestling has always been event-driven, and the size of the event, the scope of the event, and WrestleMania has become, in a lot of ways, bigger. You know, when I see what UFC is trying to do with the UFC fight the weekend in July, when they have the Fight Expo and they have the big show, they're trying to kind of tap into what WWE has created with WrestleMania, which WrestleMania now is this big brand that they can take anywhere in the country because cities are bidding on it, and it automatically produces big economic value for the cities because you have so many travelers coming in. And part of that appeal is the size of the show, right? And what's concerning this year is that a big hook of the network is going to be you're going to be able to see that show, but the concern is that the show isn't going to go off hitch-free. And so That's going to be really interesting because a lot of people are getting this network for this show, and I don't think the show is going to work.
It's a big question about whether they can handle those bandwidth concerns. Obviously, even when they did the NXT arrival event a few weeks ago during the free stream, you got to figure several hundred thousand people were logging on to watch that, and it struggled at one point there. And for some people, it was completely disruptive. For me, it was mildly disruptive. I was able to get back on. I was able to watch most of the main events. For some people, it was completely seamless. And so that ambiguity of why things aren't working right is a real struggle for WWE because they're really out of their wheelhouse here. You know, they hired MLB AD to be, or AM, to be their backbone. They hired Hart Hanks to be their customer service rep so that they themselves wouldn't have to staff up and deal with those enormous concerns. But at the same time, we have yet to be proven that, you know, you can really get 500,000 people or more trying to watch this thing at once, and the stream is not going to die. And you know that it means so much to them for the viability of their network. So they can get away with NXT crashing and no one's going to report on that. If WrestleMania dies a terrible death, there's no way USA Today doesn't throw a blurb in there somewhere.
So then, that's what I'm going to find interesting the day after, the month after WrestleMania, is because will it be spun? They're taking it off the network because they couldn't get it to work anyways, and I don't know if that's going to do any damage, but I don't think it's going to be good for such a premier show. Or maybe it will be. It's so popular that we can't have it on the network. I don't know how the company's going to spin it. But my concern is that there are going to be issues. And next year when they take it off the network, which I see as being completely logical, because if you decouple Royal Rumble and WrestleMania at the very least, right, because that was one of my things going in is, I had asked Dave Meltzer personally, I said, what's to stop someone just from subscribing January to June every year so they get Royal Rumble and WrestleMania and leaving after that? And I think if you decouple Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, and unfortunately I think you'd see a price increase as well, maybe $15, $20, that I think that's best for the health moving forward. What I love about the network personally is that just like everything else, I guess, in life, it frustrates me in some arenas, but then as a content eater, I enjoy being able to create my own personal experience with these things, and that's what I think is beautiful about the internet, and that's what I love about the network, is that I don't have to watch the programming that they're giving me. I can go in there and find the content that I'm interested in at the moment and create my own personal experience. So my experience with the network is unique to anyone else's experience because a lot of my friends on social media are posting what they're watching at the time on the network, and I can watch something completely different. And that's unlike, you know, experiences with HBO when they're showing, for example, Game of Thrones. That's all you're watching, and that's what the social media sphere is talking about, is everyone at the same time watching this one show. But I'm able to come up with my own programming experience, which I think is huge. And I think that's the way going forward with other sports leagues like NBA, MLB. I think that's going to be huge moving forward, is because I think there's a number of people who do want to do that, right? But then also you go into barriers like technology savviness, I guess, like you explained. Like some people who aren't used to getting content this way, they're not going to they're not going to find it interesting, right?
You're right, and I think content delivery is a huge piece of this because, you know, for me, what I've most enjoyed about the network has been probably the old footage, you know, watching those old NXT shows and some of that, and the territorial footage. And so it's interesting to see how they're rolling that out, in that you don't have 3 years of world championship class wrestling, you know, world-class wrestling going on with the WCW at once. Instead, it's going almost weekly by weekly, adding an episode, which for some fans is frustrating because, you know, they really want to binge watch if they want to experience almost like Netflix House of Cards, while other fans are just really enjoying, you know, pick and choose, take a little bit, take a little of that. Every week there's something new. And so I think they're smart in the sense that they are going with the every week there's something new approach rather than we're going to give it all to you at once. Especially for something, you know, where you roll up those pay-per-views, you've really delivered on the promise, right? We proved early on with WWE Classics on Demand the best you can do with just old content is probably 100,000 people. Now, maybe you could double that, let's say, if you had tons of old content, but that's not nearly enough to justify the service. So you need to add something that draws people in. And ultimately, it's those live pay-per-views. That is the real draw of why people are trying to subscribe to this, is that I don't have to buy monthly pay-per-views. Now, with that said, there's still that element of maybe there's something that's so exceptional that it can't be in this prepackaged sphere. And it's so exceptional that since I'm getting all my money from television, I want to do it on a platform that maybe even benefits some of the television partners a little bit, so they feel it's in their interest to keep promoting my product. Especially for, you know, the people that live in rural areas that aren't going to have internet that's strong enough to necessarily deliver a streaming content through the WWE Network, or people that might not be able to afford high-speed internet, or people who might live in countries where internet is bandwidth restricted, or the idea of unlimited internet is very unusual and you're not going to be able to get. So it's one of those things where there's so many other technical hurdles that have nothing to do with WWE themselves that have to be overcome. You have to find that happy medium. And so I love the fact that the network is bringing all this stuff to life. I'm afraid they're going to spend a little too much on some of the new content they're going to deliver, you know, the Legend Houses of the world, and not enough maybe on the old, you know, just harvesting their library for what it's worth. And it's a conundrum, right? Because it's not enough people sign up. They aren't incented to put more into it, but yet some people don't want to sign up because it doesn't have what they're looking for. And so it goes in this circular argument. So it will be really interesting if we are going to see those rumored all Raw, all SmackDown from history available on demand. Are we going to see a focus on the Attitude Era, on the pre-Attitude Era, on the very territorial days? Are we going to see a focus more on today as it is, you know, the NXT to the world? It's a huge question, and one that has yet to be answered in terms of what they're thinking is. I do think it's telling that WWE has spent a lot of time hiring television people. You know, you look at Matthew Singerman, who I think is like the EVP of the network. He was a guy that worked on a lot of other premium channels, the Reels channel, the Movie channel, things like that. But I'm not seeing a lot of hiring coming from the Netflixes or the Hulus of the world. And that's where the one area where I think maybe they might need to expand a little bit more in is thinking about how people interact with digital content. And, you know, they're big into binge watching. They're big into kind of consuming it all at once. And so it'll be interesting to see whether or not they do anything that maybe they put out 25 episodes at once, a whole year's worth of some product, to kind of indulge in that and then see how people deal with it. Because I think there is some interest in that, personally, just because that's what we're being trained to do through Netflix, the way they oftentimes would deliver a whole season of something at once.
And finally, the barrier of entry, I guess, very popular in the culture, I guess, is lowered, I think, on the internet, right? So House of Cards, for example, is a show that I hear a lot about. But a lot of times from the political circles that I follow on the internet, not so much people at work, no one I know at work watches House of Cards. No, actually, I take that back. I believe there's one person at work that I know watches House of Cards. But relatively, that's about it. I don't know. I've never polled them, but I don't know how many people at work would even be aware of House of Cards.
Exactly. I mean, it's like Arrested Development, you know, such a popular series online, and yet it never had the ratings as a juggernaut when it was actually being on television to stay on television. And so it finding a second life online says a lot about the fact that niche communities will band together to support things, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's in the majority of the population's interest or psyche. And so the question is, can you find a niche community and harvest it in such a way that it is profitable to that smaller venue rather than being, you know, the major Fox network as a whole?
Well, my question is going in this current strategy, is World Wrestling Entertainment acquiescing that we'll never be the boom period that a lot of fans romanticize for? Is that over? Will we ever see a wrestling boom period again, or are we just going to harvest the fan base that we currently have?
Well, you know, it's like predicting who's going to be the best actor in 10 years. You know, it's really hard to see what magic is coming down the pipeline, because obviously there's strategies you can apply to get things to the right point, but from a competition standpoint, in 1991, if you were to survey the world and say, okay, this WCW company that right now is having trouble drawing thousands of 500 to 700 people is soon going to be neck to neck with Vince McMahon, and they're going to usher in a new boom period. I don't think any one of us would have believed it. And so it's tough to say. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that they do need some form of, I hate to say competition, just because that's such an easy answer to be like, they need to compete with someone, but they need some sense of not a single monolithic driving force. And so I don't know if that's a true brand split where you treat them differently. I don't know if that comes from, I love the international territorial idea that came out a few years ago, where the idea was that they would set up separate territories in different areas of the world and then be able to use it to trade talent and to try to kind of develop things. And I think something like the WWE Network is really interesting because it gives you a platform then to display and produce those kind of shows in a different way and maybe get it out to the populace without necessarily interfering with your regional broadcast of your current program. I don't really know what the answer is in terms of what's going to lead them to the new boom. It's funny where, you know, we talk about putting people in the Hall of Fame. Sometimes I joke one of the Hall of Fame people should be the WWE CFO or something like that, because in terms of making money, the company is making so much more money than what a lot of other companies have ever done in their entire life. And yet, it comes through so many, a diversified revenue stream, that everything from making, you know, The Miz doing a Christmas holiday or whatever that movie was he did for the made-for-TV, and it comes from the licensing deal for the video games, and it comes from the live event revenue being for sold shows in Abu Dhabi. You know, they're going to make money in a lot of different ways, and it's not always the way that we think about how the Attitude Era made money. And when you really look back, the Attitude Era was only running 200-plus shows a year. Today we run 320-plus shows a year. And so what's interesting is, in some ways, we make less money per show but more money overall, just because we changed the strategy of how we can roll it out. And so I'm curious what the new hybrid Attitude Era looks like. Is I think it's silly to always look back and say, this is how you do it. You know, that's the Bill Watts booking WCW aspect, where you come in and you're 5 years too late because the world has changed. So it has to be a new hybrid version of that. I don't know where we're going to get those new athletes from. Should we be stealing them from the MMA camp? Should we be stealing them still from the Division I wrestling camp? Should we be looking for actors and charismatic people and try to scoop them off? You know, I have no idea where WWE really should be harvesting that from. But I think right now there's a question about whether or not you're really getting enough talent in the pipeline, because I do think a lot of these booms are definitely built on the backs of certain talent being at the right place in the right time. But that talent always has to be able to step up and really present. And, you know, they're in a tough place. Losing CM Punk did not help them. He was one of the few big ratings movers left. Rock Lesnar is only on a part-time deal. The Rock is not probably coming back, at least for some time here, and really showed himself to be very vulnerable to injuries. They need those new big stars, and John Cena is a big star. He's not as big as some other stars have been in the past. But they need someone else to get up there in the level of John Cena, and whether that comes from harvesting a specific international market star. You know, they tried really hard to make Alberto Del Rio as big as Rey Mysterio or someone would be, and that never worked out. Sin Cara was essentially a bust in his time there, and so, you know, I'm sure that soured them a little bit on the prospect, but I think there's a future there where you target a certain idea going on in the culture at the time, and you'd be able to really produce something with it. All of the Stone Cold Steve Austin flipping the boss off, you know, anti-authoritative streak in the late 1990s. What is that next one going to be? Who knows?
Well, Chris, thank you very much for joining me. This was a very informative and interesting discussion. If people are interested more about you, where can people go to get that?
Thanks, Alex, for having me on. If they're interested in reading any of the things I've been writing, you can check me out at indeedwrestling.com or indeedwrestling.blogspot.com. One is kind of my statistical website. One is more where I post my new articles. And then I also appear occasionally over at voicesofwrestling.com, whatculture.com, and then every now and then I'll throw an article off over on the Wrestling Observer website at wrestlingobserver.com. And it's been wonderful talking with you, and you know, it's an exciting time to be a wrestling fan, so I always enjoy getting on the horn with somebody else and just kind of talking numbers.
Well, thank you very much for joining me, and this podcast will be posted directly to iTunes and also our site at onlineworldofwrestling.com, and thank you very much for joining me. Have a great week.
right, well, that's the